I made the title of the book upon which this course is based, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Things. Now, if you look back at the history of revival that we've seen so far in the United States, you see some people who are really quite extraordinary. Jonathan Edwards was considered to be the most brilliant man in the colonies at the time. George Whitefield certainly was thought to be an incredibly exceptional speaker and had offers of many, many church posts that he could have filled. But then as you go on in time, you find people like Charles Finney. And not much theological education, and yet he was trained as a lawyer. We get to Jeremiah Lanphier. Again, theological education is lacking, but he was an experienced businessman, and he used those principles as part of the founding for the revival in 1857, 1858. But now we come to a truly ordinary person. Last time I said we were going to reserve this session just for Dwight Lyman Moody, somebody that is incredibly important in the history of revivals. He has been called God's gospel salesman because he was, above all things, a very effective salesman. So here we are, an ordinary person doing extraordinary things. His story begins on February 5, 1837. That's when he was born in an area of Massachusetts. As he grew up, he was in a large family. He was the sixth child in the family. Five of them were boys at that point, and he grew up in a fairly normal but poor family. In fact, they lived kind of on the edge of survival financially. And then when Dwight Moody was 4 years old, his father died. Now, at that point, there were seven children, left his mother with seven children. And 2 weeks after the death of his father, Edwin, she gave birth to twins. So here is a woman with nine children. Now, relatives told her they should farm the kids out, send them to orphanages, etc. And she was determined to try to keep the family together. And so she began looking for work wherever she could, but was trying to raise these twins, and life was incredibly complex at that time. Now, the pastor of the Unitarian Church was somebody who came around and provided a great deal of help to the family. When Dwight Moody was 5 years old, he was baptized in that church, and they joined that church as a result. So you really have to understand, if you're going to understand Dwight L. Moody, a little bit of the Unitarian Church. Now, the Unitarian Church, as we saw earlier, was kind of a response that took on all of the characteristics of the Enlightenment, the belief in rationality, the belief in the fact that intellect should be able to get you there, and removing anything supernatural from any belief about the Bible or belief about the stories about Jesus. And it was Unitarian Universalist is often how it is phrased, that there's a belief in a God, but everybody's eventually going to be saved. And so some of the characteristics of this particular expression of faith, they still called themselves Christian at this time, but they denied the deity of Jesus Christ. In other words, Jesus was not God. They denied faith as the means of salvation. You know, one of the hallmarks of the Christian church throughout the ages has been that salvation comes by grace through faith. But now they're saying, no, that's not the way that things happen. Reason or intellect or education was seen as the supreme good. And so the purpose of the church was not to bring people to salvation, but it was to build good character through education and reason. Maybe the most famous of the pastors in the Unitarian Church was Ralph Waldo Emerson. If you remember him, if you've had English literature classes, you've probably read some of Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of the fathers of transcendentalism, which is a belief that we can transcend our present experience through the use of reason, etc. So Moody, whatever religious training he had, and he had very little, took place within that kind of setting. In fact, when his son, Dwight Moody's son, wrote a biography back in the year 1900, he wrote that, you know, one of the things that was always in their home, in his mother's home, was a Bible. Apparently, Dwight Moody never read it because later he couldn't pass a very simple exam on some of the things that are in the Bible. So this is the background. Education-wise, he had to go to work to help support the family. So he never got more than a fifth grade education. At the age of 17, he decided to move to Boston. because he wanted to make money. He wanted to get a good job. Now, at that time, apparently jobs weren't too plentiful in Boston. An uncle had a shoe store, and he invited Dwight Moody to join his shoe store as a salesman until he could get a better job. And yet week after week after week went by, and he was a salesman. That's what he did. And he was pretty good at it, too. Now, the conversion story for Dwight Moody involves a very interesting person by the name of Edward Kimball. In fact, here's another ordinary person that does extraordinary things, and the history of the church in America would be different if it were not for Edward Kimball, though his name has been kind of lost. Edward Kimball was a teacher in a church, the Plymouth Congregational Church. Dwight Moody was attending this church and when he was in Boston, and Edward Kimball was his teacher. Now, Kimball was going through the Gospel of John with his students, a bunch of young men like Dwight Moody. And he determined that one of the things he wanted to do more than anything else was to lead each of his students to Christ. And so he would arrange to meet them outside of the church, outside of the Sunday school session, and just talk to them about Jesus Christ. And so Edward Kimball one day showed up at the shoe store, walked in, asked for Dwight Moody. He was in the back unwrapping shoes. They were shipped in paper back then, and he was unwrapping shoes. And Edward Kimball sat down and talked to him about his soul. Now, Dwight Moody, when he remembered that day, described it this way. He said, "When I was in Boston, I used to attend a Sunday school class, and one day I recollect my teacher came around behind the counter of the shop I was at work in and put his hand on my shoulder and talked to me about Christ and my soul. I had not felt that I had had a soul till then. I said to myself, this is a very strange thing. Here is a man who never saw me till lately, and he is weeping over my sins. And I never shed a tear about them. But I understand about it now, and I know what it is to have a passion for men's souls and weep over their many sins. I don't remember what he said, but I can feel the power of that man's hand on my shoulder tonight. It was not long after that I was brought into the kingdom of God." Now imagine that. This is very encouraging to me, because as I've studied revivals and I've asked God to use me in the process of bringing about revival wherever he would choose, it's interesting to me that here's a person that history would not even remember. The name would not have any significance. You wouldn't Google it and come up with a whole lot, except for the fact that he was the instrument that God used to bring somebody into the kingdom that God was going to use in a powerful way in revival. So, Dwight decides that he's going to join the church. And so he is brought before the deacon board at the Congregational Church. And on May 16, the visit with Edward Kimball was April 21. May 16, he's brought before the board. And they asked him a rather simple question. That's a picture of the church there. It's on the right on the pillar there in Boston. They asked him a very simple question. "What has Christ done for you and for us all that especially entitles him to our lives and obedience?" Now think about that. How would you answer that question? Dwight Moody was not able to give an appropriate and effective answer, so they voted and did not vote him in as a member of the Plymouth Congregational Church. They assigned two men to work with him, and it was a year later, May 3, 1856, that he was then voted in as a member, though those who were part of that interview said he didn't do all that much better, even a year later. And so you've got somebody who is really an ordinary person, maybe even less than ordinary, and yet God begins to use him in a powerful way. The story goes on for him. September 1856, he decided to move to Chicago. At that time, it was about 80,000 people. It was the new capital of the West. It was the place for opportunity. Dwight Moody's spoken goal was that he wanted to raise $100,000 in the bank. Now, remember, this is 1856. And he was well on his way. In fact, when he moved to Chicago, he had $7,000 in the bank. And so he began attending again a congregational church there. And in fact, he asked to volunteer to become a teacher there. And back then, what they would do is they would hire pews for their students. And Moody turned out to be an incredible salesman. I mean, he's trained as, of course, a salesman. And so he's out in the street, and he's talking to children, and he's talking to young people, and he begins to start bringing in people until four pews are filled. And at that point, he decided he wanted to be a teacher in one of the mission schools of the church. Now, the mission school, 1859. Back then, mission schools were not what we think of now when we think of mission schools. I supported financially a mission school for several years out in Rehoboth, and it was established about the same time as the mission school then. And the idea was that there were people there who were part of the Navajo tribe of Indians, and they weren't able to get an education anywhere else because they didn't fit in the public school system. And so you'd bring them to the mission school. Well, in Chicago at that time, they were doing some of the same things. They were bringing kids into mission schools because there were no child labor laws back then. Many children, especially among the poor, had to work all week, and Sunday was the only day they had off. So they had mission schools. Sunday, they would bring children into these schools and teach them some of the rudimentary reading, writing, and arithmetic that they would need, hopefully, to better their lives. But they would also, in this mission school, teach them about Jesus Christ. So Moody went to the head of the mission school for the Plymouth Congregational Church and said, "I'd like to volunteer." And they said, "Well, that'd be nice, but we really don't need you." At that point, they had 12 teachers for 16 students in that mission school. And so Moody went to work. He hit the streets because they said, "You can teach if you get your own class." And so he did. He piled in a class. Very soon, it was packed. And then he decided to start his own mission school in one of the poorest areas of the city of Chicago, and rented a facility. And once again, he's out on the streets. He would talk about Jesus Christ anywhere. He was so excited about his faith. He was known to stand on the steps of City Hall and preach and invite kids to the mission school in that way, and beginning to be effective. So much so that in his mission school, adults started attending because they heard of how entertaining it was to be in Dwight L. Moody's mission school classes. And so he would speak. The place began to become larger and larger and larger. And eventually it got so big that he decided to turn it over to the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, a group that he had become associated with back in Boston and renewed his association in Chicago. And in fact, he even became president of the Young Men's Christian Association and did that for a few years. Well, things were going so well in that regard that Moody had to face the challenge. Would he continue to do his work and aim toward getting $100,000 in the bank? Now, by this time, he wasn't selling shoes anymore. He was actually collecting debts. He was traveling throughout all the western area as a debt collector. But 1860 came the choice for him. Are you going to do this full-time or not? And he felt the challenge and felt God's call in his heart, and decided that, yes, this was God's call to him. Now, that was interesting because about the same time he had met a young woman named Emma Revelle. There's a picture of her. And Emma Revelle and he fell in love, and they were going to get married, but the marriage had to be postponed because of the financial situation of the couple. And so it wasn't until August 28, 1862. That they were able to get married. So Moody begins to speak regularly. This is now his full-time work, and he's working alongside of and with and through the YMCA. It wasn't until 1870 that he really began revival meetings. Up until this point, he's speaking in churches. He's speaking in mission schools. He's speaking wherever he was invited to speak. But now began the idea that maybe he could be the instigator. Maybe he could be the one who would formulate the revival meeting and set it up. And it was a meeting, Ira Sankey, that set that whole process in motion. And revival meetings began in 1870. If you're not aware, Ira Sankey was a tremendous musician, and he was the first member of Moody's team. And he was the one who provided the music, controlled the music, directed the choirs. As Moody began to expand his capability in this area of revival meetings. We've talked about revivals, where it's a movement of the Holy Spirit, revivalism, where they practice revival. Well, this was a revival meeting, where the meeting was intended to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. Things really took off for him in the years 1873 to 1875. During those years, he was in England, Moody and Sankey, and they were holding revival meetings in England, incredibly well received, occasional trips to Europe. But after that, when he came back, the large cities in the United States seemed open to his presence. So revival meetings, series of them, were held in Chicago, in Brooklyn, in Philadelphia, in New York. Now, when we look at Dwight Moody, there are several contributions to this process of revivals and revivalism and the history of revivals that he's noted for. And that's why he deserves a chapter all on his own. One is a change in the emphasis to the love of God. Now, remember back, as I quoted sessions ago now, that sermon from Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And much of the preaching tended to be on God's judgment and on the fact that you should escape hell. And so it was, truly desire to scare the hell out of you. That's what they were doing. But now Moody comes, and he is giving an entire emphasis, different emphasis, and that is on God's love. And that's partly because of his own experience. He wrote of it one time. He says, "Oh, what a day! I cannot describe it. I seldom refer to it. It is almost too sacred an experience to name. Paul had an experience of which he never spoke for 14 years. I can only say that God revealed himself to me, and I had such an experience of his love that I had to ask him to stay his hand. I used to preach that God hates the sinner. I never knew that God loves us so much. This heart of mine began to thaw out. I could not hold back the tears. I took up that word love, and I do not know how many weeks I spent in studying passages in which it occurs, until at last I could not help loving people." And so Moody is remembered as the great apostle of love, much as John is in the New Testament. So a change, a major contribution is that idea of focusing on love instead of God's judgment or hatred of sin and the sinner. Second contribution is his organization. We've seen a progression, from Jonathan Edwards speaking in his church and revival breaking out to George Whitefield speaking out in fields and in large places, open places, and coming to revival, to Charles Finney, who brought about those new measures that we've looked at. Well, Moody brought now a whole new organization into the process of bringing revivals. And so there was an organization that started as people came as kind of the front runners, came to town, and they began to pray through the town. And there was the organization of the choirs and the music and the various pastors and churches, and all of this is building on what Charles Finney had already done. And now this is Moody's organization, and he became the best-known revivalist. Third contribution we talk about with Moody with revivalism was his preaching style. Now, we've seen already that Jonathan Edwards spoke with no gestures whatsoever, if you can imagine that, and that he read his sermons, and that how that got down to Charles Finney, who began to preach extemporaneously with no manuscript. Well, Moody was an entertainer, an incredible entertainer. And so he preached with an openness, but also a humility. In other words, it became very obvious that the love of God was what was motivating him. People did not feel manipulated to give money, much as they do going to modern-day revival kind of meetings. People did not feel manipulated even to accept Jesus Christ. What they encountered was a humble presentation of God's love. Now, this was done with somebody who had a fifth-grade education. Now, imagine that. In fact, here's what one journalist wrote about him. He said, "Oh, the way that man does mangle the English language. The daily slaughter of syntax at the tabernacle is dreadful. His enunciation may be pious, but his pronunciations are decidedly off color. It is enough to make Noah Webster turn over in his grave and weep to think that he lived in vain." And yet, in that kind of situation, people were coming to faith. The other thing that he is known for, contributions to revivalism, is this man with barely a fifth grade education is known for education. Moody Bible Institute in Chicago was founded by Dwight L. Moody. Moody Church there is founded by Dwight L. Moody and the inheritors of what he did. And so a man with a fifth grade education encouraged people to go on in their education in Scripture, go on in their education about the gospel, go on in their education about theology. And if you read Moody's writings today, and they still are purchasable in a variety of places, you'll find that he was somebody who himself was trying to constantly expand his understanding and his ability to express Christianity in a contemporary but well thought out way. And so you'll find lectures to students, and you'll find sermons, and you'll find just thoughts on revival. But it's an emphasis on religion, or on education. Now, Moody, of course, died December 22, 1899. He spent some time ill prior to his death, and was best known probably for the quote I'm going to read to you next. Now imagine you've got friends visiting you as you're sick, and you're not predicted to recover from this sickness. And I've occasionally wondered what I would say, having had friends who died, and you visit them, and as they grow weaker, what are they thinking? What are they? What are these last thoughts? These are the thoughts for which Moody has become exceptionally famous and have been quoted over and over since then. He said, "Someday you will read in the papers that D.L. Moody of East Northfield is dead. Don't you believe a word of it. At that moment, I shall be more alive than I am now. I shall have gone up higher, that is all, out of this old clay tenement into a house that is immortal, a body that sin cannot touch, that sin cannot taint, a body fashioned like unto his glorious body. I was born of the flesh in 1837. I was born of the spirit in 1856. That which is born of the flesh may die. That which is born of the spirit will live forever." Dwight Moody, incredibly ordinary person. Now, I hope this is giving you some hope. You know, some hope. When I finished my study of revivals many years ago and laid the foundation for this course and the book upon which it's based, I remember a friend met me after I had come back home. I'd spent 6 months in Harvard University writing and studying. He met me and said, "Well, what did you learn about revival?" And I said, with an edge of cynicism, he said, "I found out that I am too old and too educated to be used by God in bringing about revival." And I guess that was some arrogance, because I think what we're learning here is that God could use anyone. Dwight Moody is not somebody you would have looked at and said, "Yes, that's the guy that God's going to use." Nowhere in his upbringing would you find anything that would have commended him to you to say, "Yeah, that's somebody who's coming." Nowhere in his teen years, even though he's working hard and he's trying to make a fortune, would you say, "Yep, that's the person who at the age of 17 can't even pass a very basic kind of examination for membership in a church saying what Christ had done." You wouldn't have thought that's the guy then. You wouldn't have thought it even when he was in the mission schools, because you would come and you would hear the incredibly rotten English language that he would use, or the rotten use of the English language, and you would have said, "Wow, you know, it's amazing." You know, nowhere along the line would you say, "Yes, this is the guy. This is the guy." Now that gives me encouragement in several ways. One, I never know who God is going to use. And so I've got to treat each person. And I think of the children in the congregation that I serve, as I sometimes get to walk into classes, and sometimes in the youth ministry part of this, get to engage teenagers and middle schoolers talking about things of faith. And who knows who's there that God will use? Who knows? You know, way back in the time of Martin Luther and the Reformation, back in the 16th century, Martin Luther's teacher had a habit of doffing his hat to his students when he'd come in the room. And he was criticized for that, because students were considered to be, you know, a lower level of society, and certainly a professor wouldn't do that. And so they challenged him and said, "You shouldn't do that." And he said, "Oh," he said, "but I never know who's in that room. I never know who there God might use in the future." And And so Martin Luther was used in bringing about Reformation. Well, it's the same for us today. Who around us? And maybe it's you. Maybe you look at your life and you say, well, there's nothing in me that would commend me as the next great revivalist in the United States or whatever country you happen to be in. Well, then take hope from Dwight L. Moody. Take hope that it could be. It could be. In fact, there's a wonderful story back in the book of Exodus in chapter 17. You can read about that. It's a time when the people of Israel are traveling in the wilderness. They are on their way to the promised land and they are attacked. And Joshua is told by Moses to get an army together. And these people who grew up in slavery, so they had no training militarily, they were told to get together, Joshua, an army, and go fight these folks that are attacking them. And Moses says, I'll sit up on the mountain here and watch. And you remember the story. Moses, as long as he has his hands up, the people of Israel prevail in the battle. But as soon as he gets tired and his hands come down, the enemy prevails in the battle. And so Aaron and Hur come on each side of Moses and they hold up his hands, and eventually a great victory is attained. And then God speaks to Moses. And the first thing he says is, make sure you tell Joshua. Make sure you tell Joshua. Because otherwise, he might think it's him. He might think it's his ability, his training. Incredible inspirational speech to the troops before the battle. Who knows what? So make sure that Joshua knows that it's me. If there's anything we're learning about revival, it's this. It's about God. It's not about us or our abilities or lack thereof. God will use whomever He will use. And maybe He wants to use you. That's the powerful message, and that's why we put Dwight Moody into a category of his own in this study.